On the evening of the 18th of June, 1815, with the Battle of Waterloo in the balance, Napoleon made one last attempt to win the battle. He sent in the Imperial Guard, and they marched in glorious order up the hill towards the British Guards Division, Maitland's Brigade. As they approached the ridge of the hill, to their surprise, they saw no troops in front of them. All they could see were a few mounted officers, and among them the Duke of Wellington himself. The French advanced on. And then a voice rang out. It was Wellington's. "Now, Maitland, now is your time." At his command, the British guards who had been lying down stood up, four deep and in perfect order. And with the French only 50 yards away, they poured volley after volley of musket fire into the French lines. As you can imagine, the effect was devastating. And the French attack was thrown into confusion. And then when the guards launched a bayonet charge, there was a full-scale retreat. Well, as we come to Luke's Gospel, we hear not the command of a duke, but the voice of a king. Jesus is under attack. The enemy is sending wave upon wave of delegations to question. Now, questioning sounds fairly harmless, doesn't it? But these questions are put to Jesus in order to destroy him, to catch him out. But each time at his word, they're thrown into confusion and retreat. As we come to chapter 20 of Luke, verse 27, it's now the turn of the Sadducees. Then some of the Sadducees, verse 27. Well, who are the Sadducees? Well, they're men of privilege. They come from rich aristocratic families. They wield considerable influence over the Jewish world. In many ways, they are the political classes. And what do they believe? Verse 27, then some of the Sadducees who deny that there is a resurrection came to him and asked him. When it comes to belief, people today wouldn't find it very difficult to get inside the skin of a Sadducee. Why? Well, because they're skeptics. That's their instinct. They're sophisticated, erudite, well-educated, well-read, and far too sophisticated for all this supernatural stuff. So said the fat Sadducees, there's no life after death. There's no resurrection of the dead. And therefore, by implication, no judgment to come, no heaven or hell, no angels. And therefore, say the Sadducees, much of the Bible you can't take seriously. Isn't there anything you believe? Well, we believe in God, and we believe in the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch, the law. So now it's the turn of the Sadducees to launch their attack, and they advance towards Jesus in glorious order. As far as they're concerned, they have an invincible weapon. It's in the form of a question. So please have those verses open in front of you. Luke chapter 20, verses 27 to 40. And we'll watch the unfolding drama under three points. Point number one, the question. Verse 28. They've come to him and they say, "Teacher, Moses wrote to us that if a man's brother dies having a wife, and he dies without children, his brother should take his wife and raise up offspring for his brother." They're quoting from Deuteronomy, the so-called Levirate law. What's it about? Well, for the Jewish man, few things could be more important than having children. Because children meant you would maintain the family name. You'd maintain your line in Israel. Do you know what one of the most popular pastimes is in the UK? It's tracing your family tree. We need to belong. We want to know who we are, where we fit into the scheme of things. So you'll understand where the Jews are coming from. As the people of God, their whole identity and honor was bound up with keeping the family name alive. That's how they saw the world. And so this law was a way to ensure that. It's a way of keeping the family name from dying out. If a man died childless, it wouldn't have to be the end of the line, the end of the family name. A near relative could marry his widow, and the first child would then be counted as the dead man's. And so the family name and all that it meant would be kept alive in Israel. You find an example of it in the book of Ruth. That's what the law said. So now the question. Verse 29. Now there were seven brothers. The first took a wife, died without children. And the second took her as a wife, and he died childless. Then the third took her, and in like manner the seven also, and they left no children and died. Last of all, the woman died also. Therefore, in the resurrection, whose wife does she become? For all seven had her as wife. So say the Sadducees, if we apply God's word to this situation, one woman ends up marrying seven brothers in turn. Number one dies, no children. So number two marries her to keep the family name alive. But he dies before there are any children. So number three marries her. He dies, no children, and so on, and so on, and so on. I don't know who's the unlucky one, whether it's the wife having to marry seven brothers, or the seven brothers, anyway, who marry her, and then end up dying before there are any children. But you've got one wife and seven husbands. And it's all decent and legal and biblical. Verse 33, therefore in the resurrection, whose wife does she become? For all seven have had her as wife. So they advance in glorious order towards the Son of God. Get out of that. You see what they're up to? They're using the Bible to show how absurd is belief in the resurrection. Belief in an afterlife. Do you think that God would have given that law if there's going to be a resurrection? Such a law only makes sense in this life, but it makes no sense at all if there's a life to come. It leads to a ridiculous situation. Seven men stepping forward and saying, darling, and she's got to choose which one. It's too absurd for words. Or are you saying that law given by God in the book of Deuteronomy is not to be taken seriously? Or maybe are you saying that God doesn't even know what he's doing to give such a law? So come on, what's the answer? And no doubt this isn't a new question. It's the sort of question that's one of those little hot chestnuts that goes round year after year. It's the sort of question that would have been argued endlessly, but no one's come up with an authoritative answer yet. And so they march in tight formation towards the Son of God. And they can't see how he's going to get out of this. Not this question. Therefore, in the resurrection, whose wife does she become? For all seven had her as wife. So point number two, the answer. Verse 34, Jesus answered and said to them, the sons of this age marry and are given in marriage. So says Jesus, marriage belongs to this world. Therefore, the command in Deuteronomy belongs to this world. Verse 35, but those who are counted worthy to attain that age and the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage, nor can they die any more, for they are equal to the angels and are sons of God, being sons of the resurrection. So Jesus makes a contrast between this age, this world, the one we're living in now. He speaks in verse 34 of the sons of this age, and that age, verse 35, but those who are counted worthy to attain that age. In other words, Jesus is making a contrast between this world and the world to come. Do you think the world to come is simply a continuation of this world? That as are things here, so they will be there. No, says Jesus. Those counted worthy of the new world won't live there as they've been living here. For a start, in that world, they'll have new bodies. But those who are counted worthy to attain that age and the resurrection from the dead. So says Jesus, there is a resurrection. Now, no offense, but look at your body. Or if you're proud of your body, look at the body next to you. A footballer's past his peak at the age of 30. By 40, the eyesight's in decline. What happens to our skin? It loses elasticity. There's less elastin, more collagen, and when you put those together, it equals wrinkles. Our reactions slow. Our brains tire. They lose that raw power which they had when they were young. And our joints click and seize. When you look in the mirror, what do you see? Spots? Grey hair? No hair? Unwanted hair? And as you age, the face coarsens, the gums recede, your ears keep on growing throughout your life, they get bigger and bigger. And you're constantly tired. You can't run as you once did. And that six-pack is hidden under layers of fat. And things start to go wrong, don't they? When you're young, they go wrong one at a time. When you're middle-aged, you get two or three things are going on the blink. And old age, well, the question is to ask, what's still working? And there's pain. There's an unwelcome change of shape. The muscles shrink, your height declines, and then you get into the territory of deafness. And you think it's people aren't speaking clearly, but it's because you're not hearing them clearly. And forgetfulness. And we worry where to put our feet. And we get confused, muddled, senile. And there's disease and dysfunction and finally death. These bodies don't last forever, do they? They're built for this world, not the world to come. Now, when I was younger, and old people used to complain about their aches and pains, I used to think, well, what do you expect? You're old. But now I realize that while our bodies get older, the person inside them doesn't. It's an old body, but there's still a young person inside coming to terms with their mortality. Why does it have to be like this? Why is my body as it is? And if you think about that, the answer that comes up is that something has gone terribly wrong. Looking at our bodies, something's gone terribly wrong. You only have to look in the mirror. You only have to go up to Mortlake, stand outside the crematorium. They are always busy. People are always dying. Something has gone wrong. So what is it? This body is the way that it is, and it's going the way that it is, because, says the Bible, I am a member of a fallen race, the human race, living under the anger and curse of God. Put it another way. I'm a sinner. I've wronged God. I've walked out on him. I've lived as though he's dead. He's given me two great commands. Love me, he says, and love your neighbor as yourself. Neither command have I kept for a minute. So I'm a sinner. And says the Bible, the wages of sin is death. That's why this is a body of death. That's why it, my body, can't exist beyond this world, although I will exist beyond this world. That's why this body is born to die. But having said all of that, there are some people in this world who, though they are living in a dying body, have nevertheless come to enjoy peace with God through Jesus Christ. They may be great sinners, but they've come to enjoy the peace, the calm of sins forgiven. And it's all through Jesus Christ. And they've been changed. You look at them, it's still the old body, but there's a new person inside it looking out. And so dramatic is the change, the Bible says they've been born again. Even though on the outside they still look like everyone else. Now what happens when those people die? Their bodies return to the dust. But the real them, the person living inside the body, their spirit, go to be with Jesus Christ in heaven. But that's not the end. Because at the end of the world, at the resurrection of the dead, their naked spirits will be clothed again with what? With resurrection bodies. Bodies designed for the world to come. In other words, says Jesus, verse 35, they're counted worthy to attain that age and the resurrection from the dead. So says Jesus in answer to this question, those counted worthy of the new world won't live there as they've been living here. For a start, they'll have new bodies. So there is a resurrection, he says to those who don't believe in a resurrection. But that's not all. Do they marry? No, verse 35. But those who are counted worthy to attain that age and the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage. So questions about whose wife is she going to become, they're just a non-starter. Because it's not as it is here, so it will be there. There is no marriage there. Well, someone's thinking, what? No marriage? No. Because the best of marriages here are simply an echo of the unity, tenderness, intimacy, the love to be enjoyed by God's people there. In that heavenly world, my capacity to love my wife will be greater than I can comprehend in this world. My love for her there will be more special. But my capacity to love in that special way won't be confined to the one. It'll be for all God's people. And in fact, in that world of love, there will be a marriage. It's the marriage of Christ to his bride, to his people, the church. And never did two beings exist so completely for each other. And the people of God in that world will be lost in wonder, love, and praise. But that's not all. Do they die? No, verse 36, nor can they die any more, for they are equal to the angels and are sons of God, being sons of the resurrection. So again, questions about whose wife will she be are a non-starter. No one's going to be having children in that world to come. No one's going to be worrying about keeping the family name alive because nobody dies. The way things are here is not the way things will be there, says Jesus. The people of God in that heavenly world are like the immortal angels. They're more because they're the sons of God. When they come of age, and they're clothed with glorious resurrection bodies, they will radiate with the beauty, with the glory of the children of God. They'll be filled with the Spirit of God beyond measure. They'll be drenched with the life of Christ. And they'll be the outshining of the Father. Jesus says the righteous will shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. The wonder of it all. And all because of the resurrection. Nor can they die anymore, for they are equal to the angels and are sons of God, being sons of the resurrection. So ladies and gentlemen, young people, boys and girls, the future for the lover of Jesus Christ is a glorious future. It'll be a future lived in the body, but not this old, dying body, not this mortality. God's people will be clothed with immortality, new bodies, designed for that new world, the new heavens and the new earth, beyond the reach of sin and sorrow and sickness and death and the curse forever. Indeed, as Isaiah said, eye hasn't seen, nor has ear heard, nor has it entered into the heart of man, the things which God has prepared for those who love him. So how can anyone think that as things are here, so they will be there? Imagine a room. It's small, it's dark. In the room you have a candle. You have a chair to sit on. And every day, to keep you alive, you have a crust of bread. But there's a window. It's very small. If you look through the window, you can see outside the room. Just. And what can you see? There's a world beyond your world. It's the outside. One day you'll leave your room forever and you'll go outside. In the warmth of the sun, lighting a candle looks a bit silly, doesn't it? And why should you want to sit on a chair when you can feel the soft grass beneath your feet? And anyway, looking at that chair just reminds you of your miserable old life. Why hunger for a crust of bread when you look around you and the trees, they just drop with ripe fruit? Everything is new. So why should the Sadducees apply the rules of that small, dark room to the garden paradise that lies beyond? And we can feel, can't we, the first volleys, as it were, thudding into the advancing Sadducees. But their confusion is now about to turn into full-scale retreat. Look at what Jesus says next, verse 37. But even Moses showed in the burning bush passage that the dead are raised when he called the Lord, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. For he is not the God of the dead, but of the living. For all live to him. Okay, says Jesus, even if you reject the rest of the Bible, you believe, you say, the first five books of the Bible, don't the first five books teach that there's a life beyond this life? When God met with Moses at the burning bush, were Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, were they alive in this world? No, they've been dead for hundreds of years. Did that mean then that they ceased to exist? That with their death it was the extinction of their personality? No more Abraham, no more Isaac, no more Jacob. When you're dead, you're dead. If that was true, would God then have called himself, as he spoke to Moses, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob? He spoke, and Moses spoke to him as though Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were still alive. And they are. Where? In his presence, awaiting the resurrection. God is not the God of the dead. He doesn't preside over a cemetery, just of which are just printed names. The God of the living, for all live to him. A few weeks ago, a pastor friend of mine died after a short illness. He was only in his 50s. His body died. So is he dead? In one sense, yes. Brian's not here. Is he dead? In another sense, no. Because he's there. Where? The same place as Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. And in a very real sense, he is now more alive than he has ever been. Because he's in the presence of the Lord, awaiting the resurrection of the body. Well, now the Sadducees are in full retreat. In verse 39, the scribes, who are believers in the resurrection, they like to give Jesus a pat on the back and they say, "Oh, teacher, you've spoken well." But after that, they dared not question him any more. What did the Sadducees say? No resurrection? No afterlife? No angels? We're too sophisticated, too well-read, too self-assured. In fact, they were so smug, weren't they? So smug. But they haven't a clue. Fancy dismissing the thought of the world to come by imagining that it's just a continuation of the world here. No madness. It can't be anything beyond there, because it'll just be a continuation of what's going on here. And fancy not picking up on the clues and the cues. Aren't they living in the same body as everyone else? Haven't they got bodies of death? Doesn't that body that's dying tell you that something's gone wrong? And if you know your first five books, that something's gone wrong with your relationship with God? And the far from death being the end, there's a whole world that lies beyond it. And what lies beyond it is heaven or hell. Jesus has shown they don't even understand or know the scriptures that they profess to believe. And they certainly haven't got a clue about the power of God at whose word the dead will rise. And so as we close, point number three. What of you? Are you a Sadducee? Don't mean, are you rich and aristocratic and political? Well, are you a Sadducee? You don't believe in the supernatural. When you're dead, you're dead. And you do with the Bible what the Sadducees did with the Bible. You like to use it to show how absurd it is to believe in a world beyond this world. People do it, don't they? The first chapter of the Bible, how can God create light before he creates the sun? How can God create the world in 6 days? It's absurd, isn't it? So you dismiss the rest of it. Who was Cain's wife? How did you get all the animals into Noah's ark? How can a man nailed to a cross rise from the dead? How absurd. But like the Sadducees, you see, you don't know the scriptures or the power of God. In Sri Lanka, there are wells. Every village, every group of houses have got their own well. Look down into the wells, you'll see the water. It's about 10, 15 feet down. And in the water, you'll see frogs. They spend their whole lives in the wells. Once they're in there, they can't get out. Jakan sometimes says that people are like a frog in a well. Now, is the world outside the well the same as the world inside the well? Is it? My friend, you are a frog in a well. All that you see, all that you touch, is all you've ever known, isn't it? But don't assume that that's all there is to know. For there is no world beyond your well. As far as you can see, what you can see in your well, that must be it. If the frogs thought that, we'd say, how ludicrous. What a frog would say, isn't it? Frogs talk. But actually, it's what we say, isn't it? We say, there's nothing beyond what I see, nothing beyond what I touch, nothing beyond my little world. And do you want Christ to leave you in your well? Do you want him to leave you to the cruelties of what you believe, the cruelties of atheism? That you're just a random bag of chemicals that's come together by chance. That your life in this little world is without any meaning at all. That you have no purpose. Doesn't matter if you live or you die. Because death is the meaningless end to your meaningless life. You may have come across the book, The God Delusion, written by Richard Dawkins. It says, there is no God. All that exists is what's inside the well. There is nothing beyond the well. That's what he says. Well, if what he says is true, then his book is an invitation never to take him seriously again. Why should we take him seriously? If there is no God, nothing matters. He doesn't matter. His opinions don't matter. It's all meaningless. But it's worse than that, isn't it? Do you want Christ to leave you in your well? Only to discover at the last, actually there is a world beyond my world. And on that day, it's too late. And having lived without God and being proud to live without God, it's a delusion to find that God sweeps me out of his universe into a burning hell. Is that what you want? Is it? Do you remember that small room with the window? The world outside? Jesus says, come, come, come. Look through the open window of my word. In these few verses tonight, there's enough light to see outside your dark room, to see there's something beyond. Come, he says, look through my word, see the world beyond. One day you're going to have to leave this room. Do you want to go there? Do you want to live with me forever? In fact, do you want to experience now the sunshine and wonder of that world in your small room? To live for me here. To enjoy me here. Do you want to, he's saying, verse 35, be counted worthy to attain that world? To be a child of God. To be a son of the resurrection. Do you? If you do, if you come to Christ, if he saves you, there'll be plenty of other frogs in the well who'll laugh at you. Fancy believing there's something beyond the well. And they'll laugh at you and make fun of you. But you will have discovered it's a glorious world beyond, a world which you're enjoying now, everlasting life to be enjoyed now. Do you want to be counted worthy to attain that world? The fact is, the Bible says you're not worthy, are you? You'll never be worthy, will you? You're a sinner. You've broken God's commands. There's no way you can prove your innocence on Judgment Day. Thus, Jesus says, I'm worthy. And I'm willing. I'm willing to save all who come to me. We've been here many times, haven't we? Speaks to you again tonight. Been paddling around your well for the last week. They're telling there's nothing outside it. Will you come to me? Will you come to Jesus? Lord, I'm not worthy. Lord, I've sinned. That's me. But I understand that you died on the cross to save condemned sinners. So God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Will you come? Frog in the well.